from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The 2026 Missouri legislative session is less than a month away. Lawmakers will come back to Jefferson City with new and returning priorities. One thing returning, at least for Senate Democrats, is disagreements over how the 2025 Missouri legislative session ended, with Senate Republicans cutting off debate over two voter-approved issues. Senator Maggie Nirenberg is returning for her second year in the Missouri Senate. She says despite how last session ended, it is important that the Senate stay a chamber where negotiations can happen. Nirenberg also discussed her predictions for the upcoming budget and the education legislation she would like to see passed this session. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's State House and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me via Zoom in St. Louis, in the St. Louis area, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And joining us via Zoom in the Kansas City area, she is the senator for the 17th District, which includes parts of Kansas City,
Maggie Nirenberg.
Hi, Senator. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a lot to ask, so we're going to get right into it. It kind of is a reflection. What has 2025 been like for you politically?
Whew, it has been something. Going into the Missouri Senate, there was a lot of assumptions I probably had as to what it would be like, having served in the Missouri House for 4 years and always looking over to the other side of the rotunda and assuming what that place would be like and what I would be able to do in terms of negotiating legislation on behalf of my constituents. And while I would say probably the first four months of my term in the Senate went much like I anticipated, May and then the two extraordinary sessions were left much to be desired.
Yeah, from covering last year, after years of a lot of Republican infighting in the Senate, it really looked like the Senate was functioning a lot more, with more negotiating and less grandstanding. But then those last 2 weeks happened. That's when the House ended up not passing a capital improvements bill. And then the Senate used what's known as a previous question on measures targeting voter-approved abortion and paid sick leave measures. What happened there?
What I can say, it was just incredibly frustrating to see the power of the Missouri Senate dwindle into the hands of just a couple of senators and specifically Senate leadership. I can say we as Senate Democrats were at the table every step of the way, truly until the last minutes before they decide to cut off debate. And we gave it our all. I think that is our job as senators, to continue to work, to continue to negotiate. We certainly were doing that. And it was really, really frustrating. I think going in to the Senate with many of my colleagues who have served in the House, I really was hoping that they would step up and assume the role of senators, and recognizing that it serves all of us well, it serves our state and our constituents well, when we're willing to come to an agreement. And unfortunately, none of that happened. And we turned the Missouri Senate back into a, quite frankly, a lower version of the House. I can't even see a House 2.0. When we looked at the special sessions, they even changed the rules. Republicans changed the rules to give House members essentially more power than senators. And that was maddening to see, Sarah.
How do you think the fact that PQs, which is the term that Missouri legislative obsessives use to describe a maneuver that breaks filibusters, the fact that it was used so often, how do you think that's going to change the way the Senate operates going forward?
Jason, I am very hopeful that the senators that I entered the Missouri Senate with will decide that they want to be senators. I, as many of us have served in the House, I don't know why anybody would want to go back to being a House member. As you all know, thousands of bills get filed every single year. And, you know, just try to fathom if every single one of those were to become law. There are so many ludicrous proposals out there. I know, as somebody who, you know, I have an idea, I put something forward in a bill, but it needs considerable work. And I know that even filing that bill, that we need amendments, we need debate, we need concessions. That is the purpose of the floor of the Missouri Senate, to be able to vet legislation, to have those conversations as to the fiscal impact, as to the unintended consequences. And we can only do that when we have the floor to be able to debate with our colleagues on the same side of the aisle, with colleagues across the aisle. You'll see different factions pop up. You'll see senators working on the side, coming to a consensus, and then being able to sit down. Often, as Democrats, we're not going to love everything in a bill, but we come to a point where we say, okay, we can live with this enough to move on to the next thing, and we sit down. And I think that serves both parties well, quite frankly. We've seen that certainly with different factions of the Republican caucus, where there's going to be disagreements, and they work openly to address those disagreements. And then again, sometimes openly, sometimes in offices. But at the end of the day, you come up with a better product than you began with. And I think that's what it's all about.
Right before the Republicans cut off debate during the last week of session, there were several Democrats, including yourself, who basically insinuated that 2026 is going to be a nightmare, because Democrats are going to retaliate by, I don't know, filibustering the journal, killing consent bills, you know, maybe teaming up with disgruntled Republicans to derail other things, which, you know, I think could happen for a certain amount of time, but eventually you all are going to have to pass a budget, and there's going to be things that Democrats are going to want in the budget. I'm interested to hear, like, how long this goes for before Democrats actually have to do things that are necessary for the state.
I would like to say that I'm not happy with how session ended, and I'm still not happy with how Republican leadership cut off debate. I think it's going to be imperative on all of us to restore the institution of the Senate to the place that it's supposed to be. Now, I think that looks, that can take different forms. But I do think it's important that we get back to the place of being able to negotiate legislation on behalf of our constituents. You know, you ask a good question. There's a lot pressing. I think every session is quite different. This one is no different. Every session brings different, unique challenges. I think this year, certainly when we look at the budget and some of the projected forecasts, there's a lot of uncertainties there. There's a lot of unknowns about the governor's tax plan. There are going to be so many different things that we are facing. That we are going to, you know, I think every week is going to look a little bit different depending on what is on the table. So not putting out any big projections as to what that's going to look like. But again, I think anybody who has served in the Senate, anybody that pays attention to what's been going on in the Missouri General Assembly, knows that it's a good thing that we don't pass 3,000 bills every year. And so I know that there's a lot of interest in making sure that we get back to the place that the Senate is supposed to be.
We've talked about the end of the 2025 regular session, but that wasn't the only venue that ended poorly when it came to Senate relationships. There was also the second special session regarding redistricting and an amendment that, if passed, would make it much, 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 much harder to amend the Missouri Constitution through the initiative petition process. We'll get to the second part later in the show. And I agree with Sarah that we have talked about redistricting to death. So I think we're going to hold off on dealing with every curvature of that. But what were your overall impressions of that special session, which, in my opinion, broke a lot of precedents and I think upended a lot of norms that have reigned supreme throughout the Missouri Senate over the years?
Well, you nailed that, Jason. It did upend so many norms. I think, especially, you know, I had only done redistricting once prior, but ultimately, you know, I know, and I think the citizens have made that very clear by over 300,000 signing the referendum to put the map on the ballot. I think voters want to be able to choose their politicians versus the other way around. And quite frankly, with this map, we see again, politicians in Washington, D.C., quite frankly, drawing the maps to choose their voters. And that's just inherently wrong. So the actual kind of nuts and bolts of the redistricting fight was maddening, and the fact that we didn't even get to play a part in that. And then when it came to the reforms for the initiative petition. I thought it was a little bit ironic that Republicans put forth, I think, the most egregious proposal, a proposal that had never been vetted in the General Assembly before, and that's what they pushed through, again, without any debate whatsoever on the floor of the Missouri Senate. Not a single amendment was accepted on that. Actually, I believe at the same time that the bill was put before the body, the next motion was to end the debate.
There was literally no debate. Yeah, not to interrupt. There was literally no debate. I believe Senator Brad Hudson previous questioned it as soon as it came to the floor. But continue.
Correct. So again, you talk about upending norms. That is not what the Missouri Senate is supposed to be. And so I think front and center, as we go back in January, is to making sure that we restore the dignity of the Senate.
So you did a wonderful segue for us. So what are your overall impressions for the 2026 legislative session?
Sure. I am probably, like most Missourians, I'm very interested to see the governor's tax plan. We've heard a lot about it, have not seen any specific details. So I'm very interested to see, quite frankly, what taxes he plans to raise or what taxes he would like to create elsewhere. I definitely support real relief for Missourians who are struggling right now. I think like anybody who's gone to the grocery store recently, who has been doing their holiday shopping, we are all recognizing that prices have increased significantly based on the Republican tariffs, and we need real relief. But when we talk about totally eliminating the income tax, we're talking about nearly a $9 billion hole in the state budget. So that's, you know, essentially 2/3 of all general revenue comes from that income tax. And so that tax burden would have to be shifted elsewhere. So interested to see as to where the governor plans to raise taxes.
In addition to income taxes, bills on property taxes and personal property taxes are likely going to be on the table. What are your thoughts on those bills?
Well, when we talk about personal property tax, real property tax, again, we've had a lot of conversations in recent years in the General Assembly. You know, I for one, don't want to see anybody taxed out of their home. I was a big supporter last year of making sure that we had a permanent expansion of the circuit breaker tax relief in order to allow seniors and folks with disabilities to stay in their home and not be taxed out of their home, and making sure that that was adjusted for CPI moving forward. You know, when we look at our property tax bill, I think, like, you know, I, for one, just recently cut a check to my county. And when I looked at that breakdown of taxes, what was I funding? I was funding our neighborhood schools. I was making sure that our essential services for first responders were taken care of, that our library district, that our, you know, children's service fund, our senior funds, all of those things are funded through property taxes. And again, I'm always interested to have these conversations as to what we can do to perhaps find a little bit more balance in that system. But I think, you know, bottom line, Sarah, one of the things that I would really like to see is making sure that our tax structure is a little bit more reasonable, that we're not simply paying or balancing our budget on the backs of working families. And quite frankly, that has been essentially the proposal from Republicans in recent years. You know, working Missourians, middle-class taxpayers seem to be bearing more and more brunt of our taxes, while, again, the wealthiest corporations are paying less. And we saw that again with the proposal that came out last year with what ultimately passed with the elimination of the capital gains tax.
One of the major federal bills that passed was a measure restricting what's known as the federal reimbursement allowance, and that won't affect Missouri for a couple of years, but, you know, it funds roughly a third of Missouri's Medicaid program. How do you see that affecting Missouri?
Ooh, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. And again, this is going to require Missouri to pay more just to maintain the services that we have today, like Medicaid and SNAP. And again, I think as the ripple effects of that big, awful bill trickle down, we're going to see, again, services, essential services for Missourians cut. And that's what's unfortunate, is that sometimes, I think oftentimes, we're going to actually see that end up costing all of us more money. I think when folks, for example, can't get, you know, folks with disabilities who receive care in their home or receive care in a group home aren't able to get adequate services, unfortunately, they're going to have to be forced to move into an institution, which is, quite frankly, you know, doesn't have as great of outcomes for them and cost us all more money. And so that's just an example of potential impacts of what we're going to see. And again, while it might not be this year, it is going to be sooner than later. And those are considerations that we're going to have to really start looking at moving forward.
You serve on the Senate Appropriations Committee. How difficult do you expect the 2027 fiscal year budget to be in order in terms of putting it together, given especially given the effects of the capital gains tax cut that appear to be bigger than some people expected?
Jason, I can say I'm not looking forward to the appropriation process this year for a number of reasons. I think, as you know, as you all know, but just for your audience, essentially revenue is flat. So when the governor's office this week kind of unveiled that consensus revenue estimate, I think to the tune of about $13.6 billion. But again, adjusted for inflation, that is relatively flat. At the same time, we're seeing requests from our departments. And so our departments come forward in October. They put their requests together in terms of what they would like, sometimes to better serve Missourians. So we see those in through NDIs, but we also see what they need just to maintain the current services. And what we see is just overall an increase, right? The departments are asking for more money than we anticipate that we're going to collect. So that's going to be tough. We're not going to be able to fund everything. But also through the appropriations process, I think there is now there's not the understanding moving forward on the appropriations process, or perhaps the trust between the two chambers, trust between committee members that I think were there in the past. And so I think it goes everything from the House or the budget chairman, maybe single-handedly deciding to sink House Bill 19 last year that had a lot of capital improvement projects in it, or the removal of Senator Lincoln Huff as chairman of the Appropriations Committee. I think essentially kind of overnight, because he didn't vote the way that Senate leadership wanted him to vote on a couple of bills. So I'm not looking forward to the process. I don't think it's going to be nearly as smooth as it's been in my previous 5 years in the legislature. It's going to be tough, and we're going to have a lot of tough conversations during that process.
You were one of the few legislators that brought up an issue that I've been following for several years, and that is how child abuse investigators are woefully underpaid in the state. I think that the starting salary now after the 1% increase is about $45,000 a year, which I should note is an increase from, you know, 5 years ago when they were making in the 30s, but is still not even close to states like Illinois, which offer starting salaries of $71,000. And I've talked to a lot of people about this. There really isn't much disagreement that the salaries need to increase, but it just doesn't seem to be happening. Do you think the budget woes that we just talked about are going to make it much harder to do things like that, not just for child abuse investigators, but other clearly underpaid state employees?
Yes, I have a lot of fear that we are not going to raise wages to, you know, where they need to be, especially for those who do, I think, some of the toughest jobs in state government. And Jason, I don't know if there is a tougher job in state government than what these workers in the Children's Division do. I cannot even fathom their reality, the things that they see every day, what they have to go home to at night as they, you know, grapple with not being able to do enough sometimes. And, you know, raising their beginning salaries to $45,000 certainly was a step in the right direction, but is not even near where we need to be. And again, talking about these budget woes, we're going to continue to fall behind our neighboring states. I mean, we can look at class after class of different categories of funding, right? We're near the bottom in our state funding to public education. We're near the bottom in state funding for public health, for mental health services, all of these things. And unfortunately, because of the decisions of Republican politicians recently, less money continues to come into the state while costs continue to increase.
What are some areas of legislation that you think there will be some bipartisan cooperation with? And what do you think Senate Democrats are going to have to play defense on next year?
That's a tough one. I would like to come out the gate and say, okay, we're going to agree on all of these things. Are there some things in there? You know, there's always some, you know, innocuous kind of bipartisan thing that's just cleanup language. I think so. You know, a couple things that we've had the last few years that I think have robust support. For example, clarifying the language surrounding the dissolution of marriage for a woman if she is pregnant. That nearly got across the finish line last year. I filed that again as one of my top bills. I'm really hopeful that that finally gets through. We're always going to have bills that I think support our most vulnerable that will get through. Very hopeful there. I know you always ask me about education, so I'm just going to jump the gun. I think there is a lot of bipartisan support to continue to make sure that we are funding great public education in the state. As a, you know, teacher for over 13 years, I saw firsthand every day how great education had the power to open doors for students. Opportunities that they never thought were possible became possible through that education. And I've been so grateful for the relationships that I formed with members from my party, from across the aisle, from the most rural Republican who come to the table to say, we've got to do better and continue to ensure that all students have opportunities for this great education. So while sometimes that means that we're playing defense against certain things, whether it's the further privatization of funding of schools through the voucher program or through, you know, hitting the brakes on the open enrollment proposals out there. You know, education's an evergreen topic. And again, I think more often than not, we find space for bipartisan support.
So we will talk education, but we need to take a quick break first, but we'll be right back. And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is State Senator Maggie Nirenberg, who represents the 17th Senatorial District, which includes parts of Kansas City. I kind of left a cliffhanger in education. Let's get right back into it. It feels wrong having you on this podcast and not talking extensively about education. What are some priorities that you're hoping will pass this year?
I really hope that we fully fund the foundation formula. Again, that was something that came out of the Senate Appropriations Committee with bipartisan support. It came out of the committee unanimously, and we were able to fully fund the formula despite the governor putting forward a recommendation that underfunded the formula, but to the tune of about $300 million. Very hopeful that we go and make sure that we have the full funding for our neighborhood schools so they can continue to serve our communities, as well as that transportation categorical. That's another important piece. Schools have to provide transportation. And so making sure that they have the resources to do that, that doesn't require them to take out of other areas like after school programming, for example. There's been some, I think, really great proposals out there to fully fund lunch programs and making sure that that's not a barrier for any family or any school to have to administer. So there's some cool stuff out there. One of the things that I really have enjoyed working with Senator Joel Carter on and members of the House on as well. Former Representative Paula Brown was really front and center in these conversations, is the Educational Freedom Act, which gives schools a lot more leeway to get away from the burden of the annual testing. And anybody who has kids in school know that, you know, when they start testing there in third grade, it kind of sucks the love of education out of them a little bit. And I think there's a lot to be desired with our MAP tests, our annual assessments, as well as our end of course exams for high school students. And I really hope that we can go back while, you know, we still want to see schools are educating students to their full potential and making sure that we have accreditation in place, making sure that they're meeting certain metrics. I think the burden of testing is forcing so many teachers out of the classroom, quite frankly. Teachers today don't have the autonomy to be able to practice their craft and really teach. And despite what anybody says today, teachers are still forced to teach the test because they know that so much is tied to that testing. You know, measurement to those APRs when they come out at the end of the year. So I'm hopeful that we can continue to work to support educators so ultimately that they can be the best teacher possible. You know, we say this a lot. I know, you know, Commissioner Carl Esslinger will say it today. There's no more important metric to a student's success than that teacher that's right in front of them. And we want to make sure that we continue to support great teachers being in all of our classrooms.
One of the other things that passed this year was $50 million in I think general revenue to the state treasurer's office for the state's private school voucher program. This year, Treasurer Vivek Malik wants $100 million, according to the Post-Dispatch. What are your thoughts on that getting through the process, given that we have already established that it's going to be a challenging budget year?
Well, first, Jason, I still do not believe that money is constitutional. We obviously have lawsuit pending on that right now. It's unconstitutional to use public dollars for private schools, and that's what that appropriation did. So really hopeful that we'll see that play out in the court and hopefully tell the General Assembly that they cannot appropriate general revenue for that purpose. You know, I've talked to so many constituents about this and Missourians from across the state. And bottom line is Missourians believe that public dollars belong in public schools. I'm very concerned about the further privatization of public schools. Recently, I was in Washington, D.C. with education leaders from across the country in different lawmakers. I remember talking with one lawmaker from Arizona, and she goes, let's talk vouchers. And here's a cautionary tale. These schools that are receiving vouchers will just continue to raise their tuition. They're not going to tell you how students are doing. They're not going to, you know, show any proof that they're improving educational outcomes. But you know what it is going to do? It's going to continue to cost taxpayers more and more money every single year. We've seen that play out in Arizona. We've seen that play out in Indiana. And Missouri is just trying to, continue this broken path. I think a lot of people are concerned about privatization of public education, and that's what this is.
You also mentioned the school foundation formula. How confident are you that it will be fully funded this year?
I'm hopeful. I don't want to say that, you know, that I'm certain by any means that it is going to be fully funded, but I am hopeful. Again, that's something that came out of our appropriations committee last year unanimously. Even with the new appropriations chair, Rusty Black, at the helm, I think he was a public school teacher for his entire career. And I'm very hopeful that he'll see the need and the importance of fully funding that formula. So we will see. That's a huge hit. You know, when you break those numbers down, if the General Assembly decides not to fund it, that's a huge hit to every single school district across the state. And again, real impact. They have to make real decisions as to what classes they're going to have to cut or what classes they're going to have to combine or how large class sizes are going to be. And that's, again, all to the detriment to the students that they are there to serve.
You mentioned open enrollment. That's made its way through the House the last couple of sessions, only to kind of grind to a halt in the Senate. Are you expecting a similar scenario this year? What are your thoughts on open enrollment?
You know, I haven't had any conversations with colleagues over the interim about open enrollment. Again, I anticipate that it's kind of an evergreen topic, that it's going to be there, that we're going to see it again. But there's been a lot of opposition to this as well. And I'm curious as to if this goes forward first before the foundation formula. I think there's a lot of what I would really like to see in terms of conversations over, you know, school district consolidation. I really hope that the General Assembly puts forward some carrots for schools to combine resources, perhaps, instead of just the stick approach. And I feel like open enrollment is just it would really force that school consolidation faster than many communities would want. I don't think, Sarah, it's a good thing for in any area for a kindergartner to be on the bus for 2 hours. But unfortunately, in some rural areas, that would be the reality. And so I'm hoping that, you know, the state can put forward some incentives that encourage school districts to consolidate some resources, but to do it again by that local decision as to how best to proceed versus the state coming in and saying, here's the reality. You know, here in my area, we already do a lot of things where we share resources. In the North Kansas City School District, we're really proud to be members of the Northland Career Center or the new Northland Workforce Development Center, where all the school districts come together to provide really great career technical education for students. That's an area where we can share resources. And I think that's a great thing for our community and a net benefit.
Another area or another topic within the kind of school choice conversation is expansion of charter schools. Obviously, 2 years ago, it expanded to Boone County. Are you expecting that to have some momentum, maybe in the Kansas City or St. Louis County areas? I mean, thoughts?
Yeah, I really don't think we are going to see momentum for charter school expansion. I think for a long time, and Democrats included, right? I want to preface this by saying charter schools expanded more under the Obama administration than at any other time. Charter schools are not the silver bullet. We had recently an education committee hearing where we saw that out of the 40 worst performing schools in the state of Missouri right now, they're, you know, more than half are charters. In the 20 plus years that charters have been open, nearly half have closed. And so I'm really not anticipating any further expansion or any real emphasis on the expansion of charter schools. I certainly think the charters that are there, we need to continue to support and make sure that they're able to provide the best possible education for the students in their schools. But moving forward in terms of expansion into other areas, I don't think there's any real support or momentum for that.
All right, let's talk elections, even though you will not be on the ballot in 2020.
Thank goodness.
I know.
I'm really excited to enter the Senate and only have to run every 4 years. Those who serve in the Missouri House, thank you for doing so. But it is grueling to have to run every 2 years. But obviously, yeah, a lot to anticipate here in the 26th midterms.
And that is a backdoor way of taking yourself out of the sixth congressional district race. I'm not even sure if you're in the sixth congressional district under the old map, but you are under the new
under,
map.
Nope, under the old map, I was in the fifth. In the new map that I do not anticipate will stick, because I think voters are going to say hell no to that. Clay County was drawn into the sixth.
All right, let's talk about what we talked about earlier, which is the measure that would require any constitutional amendment that is put on the ballot through the initiative petition to not only get a majority of the vote, but to get a majority of the vote in 8 out of 8 congressional districts. I have said, and I don't think that this is pejorative, this is the most restrictive measure ever proposed to make it harder to amend the Constitution. I got to be honest with you, Senator. A lot of Republicans are really confident this is going to pass because it has all these other ballot candy things on it, including like banning foreign donations to ballot initiatives. How confident are you that this could be defeated?
I'm very confident it's going to be defeated. I have no doubt whatsoever that voters are going to see through the nonsense of the ballot candy, and voters are not going to vote to take away their power. This will be defeated resoundingly, Jason.
The other thing that Republicans put on the ballot at the end of the 2025 session is a measure that would repeal most of Amendment 3 from 2024, which was the abortion rights amendment. It is called Amendment 3 in 2026. So I guess we'll call it Amendment 3 2026 version. Also, I've heard a lot of Republicans very confident that this could pass, primarily because it includes a provision that would ban most gender-affirming care for minors. This gets at a point that I bring up all the time. It does not ban all gender-affirming care for minors because it allows for gender transition surgery for babies that are born intersex, which I know seems like a pedantic point, but I think is actually a really important point that gets continually glossed over, including in the ballot summary. But that aside, how do you think this is going to go toward voters, given that Amendment 3 did not pass by a resounding margin in 2024, and given that it has that aforementioned ballot candy that could be quite appealing to people?
This is going to be a tough one, Jason. But again, I think voters are smart. I think they're going to see through the nonsense of the ballot candy. And I believe that Missourians across the political spectrum believe in the constitutional right to reproductive freedom. I think that Missourians are going to educate themselves. They're going to recognize that this is another Republican trick, that we just voted on this in 24. And I think Missourians are going to move forward in voting no on this version of Amendment 3.
Do you expect, if the new Amendment 3 fails, that Republicans are just going to stop trying to repeal Amendment 3 from 2024? Because I'm going to put myself in their shoes for a second. There's a lot of Republicans who run for political office, and they genuinely feel abortion is wrong and morally repugnant to them. I don't think that changes just because Amendment 3 is on the books. I guess an analogous example is in 2004, Missourians banned same-sex marriage. That didn't stop a lot of people that wanted to see same-sex marriage legalized from trying to fight it. Do you think this issue is just going to be kind of a never-ending battle since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and allowed states to ban abortion or not?
Unfortunately, we are never going to be done talking about abortion. This will always be a topic. Again, because it is back to the states, I think it is going to be another evergreen topic. We'll be talking about abortion and, you know, 24, 26, 28, it will always be on the table. And while, you know, I am a adamant supporter of reproductive rights, of access to abortion, I recognize just because Missouri had an abortion ban in place, it did not stop people who needed care from accessing care. Those who had the resources were going across the border. And that will always be the case. And so I always think it's a little bit funny for Missourians, those who tout being anti-choice, to come forward and say, gosh, look at this, we've eliminated abortion in Missouri. You have not. People are just figuring out other ways to get care. Unfortunately, sometimes to the detriment of their own health. Bottom line is, I would like nothing more than be able to put this issue to bed and talk about other issues that are actually impacting, you know, families, the lowering cost, making life a little bit more affordable. But instead, so much time, energy, and resources get sucked up in this one topic.
Going to closer to home, so to speak. I think that they're the top candidate races next year are going to be several state Senate contests. With all due respect to the candidates who are going to run against Scott Fitzpatrick, he's going to be heavily favored until Democrats can figure out how to get a rural, suburban, urban coalition together. And I don't think the auditor's race is going to be that time.
That's not the time we're all going to coalesce and finally save the day in Missouri.
No, not. And also, like, what are you going to argue Scott Fitzpatrick has done badly? He hasn't audited well enough. Like, it's difficult to defeat a state auditor, although it did happen in 2010. So correct. I'm contradicting myself.
Yeah. But yeah, that's fair, Jason. And quite frankly, the auditor seems to be doing a pretty darn good job. So I think that's fair in saying that the focus really is going to be on these state Senate races, and I'm excited. Yeah, ask your question.
I appreciate you interrupting my long-winded soliloquy. So I think that there are really three opportunities. One is in the Springfield seat that is represented by Senator Lincoln Huff. The second one is Senator Mike Searpoy's seat, and you have two strong Democratic candidates in that, Betsy Fogel in Springfield and Representative Kerry Engel in Jackson County. There's also Senator Lukemire's seat, which is also ostensibly competitive, but I think that's harder than the other two. Just frankly, it's not as easy as the other two. And Democrats don't even have a candidate announced in that. So two questions on that. What are your thought processes right now about flipping the 8th and the 30th district? And is the 34th out of reach if you can't get a solid candidate in that district?
Okay, so let's, I'm going to start by saying that I would not want to be a Republican running on in either of those districts right now. You can look at where the political winds are across the country in other competitive races. Just look what, you know, transpired recently in Virginia. You know, look what happened in Tennessee and in districts that were historically plus Trump 20, et cetera. I certainly wouldn't want to be in districts that are, you know, a 51-49 or a 52-48 as a Republican right now and trying to make a case as to how actually your family's okay. I know you feel the pain every time you go to the grocery store or the pharmacy, but trust us, it's going to get better soon. I mean, that's a really tough argument to make. And it always is a tough argument to make when your own party is in the White House. I think, you know, all the nonsense that Donald Trump continues to spew is only hurting Republicans in these districts. And as you said, we've put forward two incredible candidates that have worked tirelessly in the House. They're running really great campaigns. I feel really good about our chance of flipping Senate District 30 in Springfield with Betsy Fogel. I feel great about our chances of flipping Senate District 8 in Lee Summit, and again, or Eastern Jackson County. And again, that one's a little bit closer to home. So I think I have my pulse there, but the momentum really is shifting in our direction. And then I want to talk about 34. Again, this one's not out of reach either. You know, I don't know exactly the latest numbers. I'm thinking maybe it's a 45% Democratic, 55% Republican district. But again, that is in that margin that we're seeing across the country right now. And we have several people who are very interested in running for that. I think we put out the right candidate who has the roots in Platte County, Buchanan County. I think we can make the case as to why it serves Missourians well when we have Democrats in those seats, that when we have, when we're able to break a supermajority, when we don't have one party that controls everything in the state of Missouri, people recognize that dissent is a good thing and that it brings a little bit of balance. And I think we can really make that argument across the state.
Well, we'll find out in less than a year if that is the case. Until then, we are out of time to chat. Thank you so much, Senator Nirenberg, for joining us today. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can find all of our reporting at stlpr.org. Senator Nirenberg, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
I'm on all the socials at Maggie4Mo.
All right. Well, that's it. Until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lippman, and me, Sarah Kellogg. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts.